Palestinian officials say 12 people were killed during heavy fighting around northern Gaza as Israel presses on with its offensive against the militant group Hamas.
That was an Israeli airstrike, according to the Palestinians. Israel has not yet put out a statement about that, but there's really heavy fighting almost all over Gaza.
Plus, in a show of continued support and solidarity with Ukraine, a top U.S. official makes a surprise visit to the country.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's arrival in Kyiv early Monday was a brazen display of Western solidarity.
And Latvia and Lithuania have enacted laws empowering border guards to remove migrants and refugees crossing over from Belarus. Today is Tuesday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Kim Lewis. Heavy fighting erupted Monday around a hospital in northern Gaza as Israel pressed on with its offensive against the militant group Hamas. Palestinian officials in Gaza say at least 12 people were killed among the constant shelling and gunfire. I spoke with Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem for an update on the situation, including where hostage negotiations stand at this point. So, Linda, can you tell us what is the latest situation with the fighting erupting around a hospital in northern Gaza and also killing 12 people?
Yes, that was an Israeli airstrike, according to the Palestinians. Israel has not yet put out a statement about that, but there's really heavy fighting almost all over Gaza. At the same time that President Biden said he sees a deal for the hostages getting closer. There were also 36 premature babies in Shifa Hospital. That's a different hospital than where the fighting was, but Israel says it uncovered a whole network of tunnels and that they believe that at least some of the hostages were held there. And there were 29 babies who were evacuated over the weekend to Egypt because there was fear for their life. Unfortunately, some of the babies died en route, but 29 of them did reach Egypt and are getting treatment there.
Yes, I'm glad to hear that. So those people that were just killed at the Gaza hospital, those 12 people, can you tell us more about that? Who were these people?
Yes. So they were Palestinian civilians from Gaza who were sheltering at the hospital. Since the fighting broke out, a lot of Palestinians have left their homes because Israel said that it wasn't safe for them to be in northern Gaza. But not all of them were able to leave. So those who were killed today were either those who hadn't left or who were sheltering at the hospital or were patients. Although it seems that it was people who were just, at the hospital sheltering, trying to find a way out of the fighting.
Also, as you mentioned, the White House says negotiations to get more than 230 hostages held by Hamas released are closer to an agreement than they have ever been before. So I know they're not revealing the details of this very delicate negotiation, but do you have any information to enlighten us?
Well, it's not for all of the 240 hostages, unfortunately. And I think it's important that we say that at least some of the hostages are not believed to be alive anymore. It's really not clear how many of them are alive. Among them, by the way, over 20 citizens of Thailand who the Thai government says they do believe are alive. But this is only a partial deal. The idea is that Hamas agreed to release 50 hostages over a period of 5 days, in which there would be a 5-day ceasefire during that time. During those 5 days, a lot of humanitarian aid would come into the Gaza Strip. Israel has allowed some humanitarian aid in, but it's not nearly enough given the situation in Gaza, which is becoming increasingly desperate. Even before the war, by the way, the World Health Organization said that more than 90% of the water in Gaza was not drinkable. Now, the hostages who will be released are believed to include women, children, the elderly, and the ill. And, there's sort of a debate because some in Israel say that stopping the fighting at this point would be a mistake, that Israel has Hamas on the run at this point, and that if they take a 5-day break, Hamas will be able to rearm, will be able to hide in tunnels, which is what they're doing now. At the same time, the hostages' families have been of course, you know, trying to get public support. That last week they held a 5-day march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And by the end in Jerusalem, they had more than 30,000 people with them calling on the government to do everything possible to get these hostages released. You know, today happens to be World Children's Day, and there are 40 children among the hostages.
That was Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein speaking with me from Jerusalem. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin slipped unannounced into Kyiv Monday to reassure Ukrainian leaders that the United States will continue to support their country's fight against Russia's invasion. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the secretary on his surprise trip to the Ukrainian capital.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's arrival in Kyiv early Monday was a brazen display of Western solidarity. It's his first visit to the Ukrainian capital since April 2022, and the first time members of the press made the surprise trip into the war-torn nation with him. Austin came here to discuss the immediate winter fight and to plan for future security assistance to Ukraine. Senior defense officials say the U.S. will provide a steady stream of security assistance throughout the winter. The most important capabilities in the coming weeks will be air defenses, according to officials, which the U.S. and Western allies have surged into Ukraine. The onset of winter has Ukraine and the West convinced that Russian President Vladimir Putin will resume its targeting of critical infrastructure as it did last winter, leaving many citizens without power in some of the coldest days of the year. Nearly 40 Iranian-made drones launched from Russian territory bombarded Ukrainian air defenses over the weekend. Ukraine said its forces destroyed 29 of the 38 drones, but those that made it through Ukraine's defenses struck multiple infrastructure facilities and caused power outages in more than 400 towns and villages throughout the country. Some of the drones also targeted Kyiv in the second attack on the capital so far this month. Ukrainian officials said all drones targeting the capital were shot down. Carla Babb, VOA News, Kyiv.
Latvia and Lithuania have enacted laws empowering border guards to remove migrants and refugees crossing over from Belarus and denying them asylum. From Vilnius, Lithuania, reporter Henry Wilkins hears stories of those who have experienced the so-called pushback laws or lost their lives after being forced back to Belarus.
Sonia Hernandez and her husband fled Cuba to escape persecution for opposing its political regime. They flew to Russia, went to Belarus, and from there entered Lithuania, an EU member state, on foot. A humanitarian group helped them obtain court documents, allowing them to stay in Lithuania long enough to claim asylum. But when they applied for asylum, Hernandez says the authorities immediately deported them to Belarus. She said she had a court document saying they were allowed to stay in Lithuania until May 6th. But then they asked the border authorities for help with asylum. They were told Lithuania doesn't give political asylum and that they should return to communism and be content with Fidel and Putin. She says they then spent weeks in the forest on the Belarusian border, trying to get back to Lithuania. She shows pictures of the frostbite she sustained during that time. So-called pushbacks, where asylum seekers and migrants are physically removed from a country and denied the chance to claim asylum, are generally considered illegal under international law. This year, however, both Lithuania and neighbouring Latvia have legalised them in what they say is an attempt to mitigate the security threat from Belarus, a Russian ally. Non-profits say some asylum seekers have lost their lives in the Lithuanian forest after being pushed back. The Sienos Group, an initiative assisting the migrants, has tombstones engraved for what would otherwise be the unmarked graves of migrants and asylum seekers who have died in Lithuania. Once pushed back, many, perhaps most migrants, try to re-enter Lithuania through the forest. Mantautas Sulskus is with Sienos Group.
So two cases of death confirmed on the border. So one of them was Sri Lankan citizen who was, we know that he was in Vilnius, so he was pushed back multiple times. He managed to reach Vilnius and he was caught and deported from Vilnius, and later his body was found.
Sienos Group also organised meetups for migrants and asylum seekers in Vilnius. Rights groups have expressed concerns that the pushbacks are often violent and endanger lives. They say some new arrivals are held in processing centres that do not allow them to leave, amounting to de facto detention, which is also against EU law. The Court of Justice of the EU says the pushback laws prevent access to international protection, and Lithuania's constitutional court has declared them unconstitutional. Alexandra Indile is a project manager for the Human Rights Monitoring Institute.
These positions do pressure the current government to make changes. Lithuania is now going to consider passing some laws which are softening the current position. So, for example, the de facto detention might be look differently in the future.
Lithuania's State Border Protection Services did not respond to a VOA request for comment on the situation. Sonia Hernandez says she misses her home country, but can never return because of the persecution she suffered. They have taken everything from us, she says. After months of trying, Hernandez successfully claimed asylum in Lithuania after being rescued from the forest by the humanitarian group. Others were not so lucky. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Vilnius, Lithuania.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Innovations in food production could alleviate hunger for millions of people, according to Britain, which hosted a global summit on food insecurity Monday. But critics say the focus on technology ignores the growing inequality of wealth. The summit was a joint initiative between Britain, Somalia, the United Arab Emirates, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. South Korea's military has warned North Korea not to go ahead with its planned spy satellite launch. A senior officer suggested Monday that South Korea could suspend an inter-Korean agreement to reduce tensions and resume frontline aerial surveillance in response. President Joe Biden spent part of his 81st birthday observing the White House tradition of pardoning Thanksgiving turkeys. Gobblers Liberty and Bell received executive clemency Monday at a White House ceremony. Biden mentioned his age and joked that he wasn't at the first of these events held 76 years ago. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. Fighting in Sudan rages on 7 months after war erupted between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group in mid-April. Regional and international efforts to mediate the crisis have failed, while human rights abuses by both sides have gone unpunished. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo reports.
7 months have passed since the war in Sudan broke out, and there is no end in sight. Mohamed Osman, a researcher for Human Rights Watch, who covers Sudan, says there are many reasons this war may go on even longer.
The culmination of regional and international failure in their engagement in Sudan, on one hand, but equally on the other hand, it speaks volume to the two generals, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo Hemeti, and the way they are waging the war with significant civilian harm. It's unfortunately something we may continue to see if these generals are not feeling or fearing any set of consequences.
As a humanitarian crisis in the country worsens and ethnic violence escalates in the western region of Darfur, a senior United Nations official warned last Friday that violence against civilians in Sudan is verging on pure evil. With no mechanism to punish or prevent atrocities, it's hard to see anything positive coming out of any talks, Osman said. And there is more.
If we are looking at the constellation of the Jeddah process in particular, I mean, two things stand up. One is the stirring lack of civilian representation, including from civil society groups, you know, the protest groups and other key actors and key voices. And then the second thing is we are not really seeing civilian protection and accountability issue being present at any stage so far.
On Tuesday, Doctors Without Borders, better known by its French acronym MSF, sounded the alarm on a Sudanese army ban they say is preventing life-saving surgical supplies from being transported in areas of Khartoum controlled by RSF soldiers. Claire Nicolet, MSF's deputy manager of emergencies for Sudan, explains the reason that were given, justifying the ban.
It was a bit unclear, but then it was kind of clarified that the idea is not for us not to treat soldiers, RSF soldiers, inside these hospitals. Problem being that most of our patients are not even fighters, and the problem being as well that a fighter who is wounded is not anymore a fighter anyway by humanitarian law.
According to MSF, on September 10th, when Goro Market in Khartoum was bombed, 43 people were killed, while 60 wounded people were treated at Bashir Teaching Hospital, including women and children. However, MSF had to stop providing surgery in that facility in October because of the ban, Nicolette told VOA. Another facility known as the Turkish Hospital is now one of the only facilities in southern Khartoum with a fully functioning operating room. But there are not enough supplies left in the hospital to last for even a month, MSF says.
For Khartoum, fighting is ongoing. Our team are still managing to work, even though, honestly, it starts to be more and more complicated. Because of the lack of supply and the lack of possibility to moving in and out our teams at the moment. So we are receiving still lots of wounded, lots of women for cesarean section and delivering as well, lots of patients, pediatric patients or children.
In addition, Nicolette says there are other issues in other parts of the country.
Even in Wan Medani, there is a cholera outbreak at the moment. So already team is busy with this. Also, the city received like four times the population they used to have because of people going out of Khartoum. Prices on the market are completely crazy. So even for surviving, it's almost difficult for everyone living in Sudan at the moment.
During a recent visit to Kenya, Sudanese Army General Al-Burhan held talks with Kenyan President William Ruto, whom he had rejected as a lead mediator from the IGAD bloc earlier in the conflict. Together, they agreed to work towards a framework for ending the war, including finding ways to accelerate the Jeddah process towards a cessation of hostilities in Sudan. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Indigenous rangers in northern Australia have started managing herds of feral animals from space. In the largest project of its kind in Australia, the so-called Space Cows Project involves tagging and then tracking 1,000 wild cattle and buffalo via satellite. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Water buffalo were imported into Australia's Northern Territory in the 19th century as working animals and meat for remote settlements. When those communities were abandoned, the animals were released into the wild. Their numbers have grown, and feral buffaloes can cause huge environmental damage. In wetlands, they move along pathways called swim channels, which have caused salt water to flow into freshwater plains. This has led to the degradation and loss of large areas of paperbark forest and natural waterholes, as well as spreading weeds. Under the so-called Space Cows program, feral cattle and buffaloes are being rounded up often by helicopter, tied to trees, and fitted with solar-powered tags that can be tracked by satellite. Scientists say the real-time data will be critical to controlling and predicting the movement of the feral herds, which are notorious for trashing the landscape. Most feral buffalo are found on Aboriginal land, and researchers are working closely with Indigenous rangers. They carry out sporadic buffalo culls, and there are hopes that First Nations communities can benefit economically from well-managed feral herds. The technology will allow Indigenous rangers to predict where cattle and buffalo are going and cull them or fence off important cultural or environmental sites. The data will help rangers stop the animals trampling sacred ceremonial areas and destroying culturally significant waterways. Scientists say the satellite information will allow them to predict when herds might head to certain waterways in warm weather, allowing rangers to intervene. In recent years, thousands of wild buffalo have been exported from Australia to Southeast Asia. Andrew Hoskins is a biologist at the CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, Australia's national science agency. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's AM programme, this is the first time feral animals have been monitored from space.
This really, you know, large-scale tracking project, probably of the largest scale from a wildlife or a buffalo tracking perspective that's ever been done. The novel part, I suppose, is then that links through to a space-based satellite system.
Australia has had an often disastrous experience with bringing in animals from overseas since European colonisation in the later 1800s. It's not just buffaloes that cause immense environmental damage. Cane toads, brought to the country in a failed attempt to control pests on sugarcane plantations in the 1930s, are prolific breeders and feeders that can dramatically attack native insects, frogs, reptiles, and other small creatures. Their skin contains toxic venom that can also kill native predators. Feral cats kill millions of birds in Australia each year, while foxes, pigs and camels cause widespread ecological damage across Australia. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Cybersecurity is critical to international development and humanitarian aid, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power. Speaking at the Countering Ransomware Initiative Summit in early November, she underscored that USAID works to advance development across a wide spectrum of sectors, as well as democracy, governance, and human rights. Each of these sectors is increasingly using digital technologies, which in turn need to be protected from cyber threats. As Administrator Power recently said in a tweet, development is digital. All technologies are vulnerable to cyber attacks. Ransomware is a form of cyber attack against a computer system wherein the attacker takes a victim's data hostage and then extorts money for its release. These attacks use malware to encrypt a victim's files, making them inaccessible, and attackers will sometimes threaten to publish sensitive data if they are not paid. In recent years, ransomware attacks have affected both U.S. partner nations and international development organizations. To reduce cyber vulnerabilities, USAID is strengthening cyber protections for its programs, as well as the cybersecurity of partner governments. Digital technology has an incredible capacity to drive development progress. To enable that capacity, international development organizations must prioritize cybersecurity to prevent potentially catastrophic cyber attacks. The 2017 NotPetya attack against Ukraine is a particularly vivid example of the impact cyber attacks can have on a country's development trajectory, said Administrator Power. That attack hit at least 4 hospitals in the capital alone, 6 power companies, 2 airports, more than 22 banks, and almost every federal agency. All were brought to essentially a standstill as the systems that allowed them to perform everyday tasks were taken offline, said Administrator Power. NotPetya had caused an estimated $10 billion in global economic damage in Ukraine. The lesson the world learned from the NotPetya attack is that cybersecurity is crucial to ensure sustainability across every sector of development. Today, USAID works with partners around the world in governments, nonprofit organizations, universities, and private companies to strengthen their cybersecurity skills and protect their digital systems. These efforts are driving sustainable, locally led digital transformation that is absolutely critical to lifting countries out of poverty, helping them escape death and distress, said Administrator Power. Helping our partners strengthen their own cybersecurity protections not only helps prevent attacks that can halt or reverse development progress, said Administrator Power, it also opens up a whole new world of possibility to use technology to supercharge development progress.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.